You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a human rights expert looks at Pope Francis's trip to Myanmar this week. A lot of human rights concerns there. People around the world wondering if the Pope would mention the Rohingya population there by name. We'll find out what happened and look at international human rights and genocide. First, the NFL has been at the center of controversy over police violence, race, and patriotism for over a year now. Protests during the national anthem have continued this season and have divided many, including Packers fans here in Wisconsin. Now, NFL executives are considering changing the national anthem policy altogether if the protests keep going. The demonstration started last season with Colin Kaepernick. He was then a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. Kaepernick refused to stand during the national anthem to protest police violence against African Americans. Mark Maskey covers the NFL for the Washington Post. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I know there's not an official statement on this from the NFL, but there are reports that NFL owners are going to change the anthem policy. What kind of changes are they looking at?
You know, we'll see. I mean, that's not something that's going to happen this season. I think, you know, my understanding is that there are a number of owners where if the protests continue until the end of the season, you know, and then they get into the off season and they go to the annual league meeting in March, that there would be a very good chance that those owners would push for just basically reverting to what the policy was before 2009. People may not remember, but before 2009, teams were not required to be on the sideline, on the field for the anthem. Players didn't have to come out for the anthem until after. Didn't have to come out to the field for the game until after the anthem. That would be what they would possibly go back to. It would be what many owners would favor. And then you just sort of avoid the problem. You don't have the players on the field. You eliminate sort of the optics of the players kneeling by just having the players in the locker room during that time. So that's sort of a contingency. I think that would only be considered if you see the protests continue through the end of the season, especially once we get into the, you know, the postseason games and especially the Super Bowl, when everyone is watching. If you see the protests happen then, I think there would be a good chance of the owners taking some action during the offseason aimed towards a change for next season.
The owners concerned that this could be bad PR for the NFL, the protests, obviously a controversial issue. Is there an indication that, in fact, these protests are hurting viewership for the NFL?
You know, that's been something that everyone has been debating, sort of going back to last season. We've seen the viewership numbers decline for the NFL. The NFL still remains a very strong television property. It's still the best thing going on television. But, you know, why have they gone down? It's an interesting question when you sort of look at television viewership as a whole. People view their programming differently nowadays. You know, they watch video on their phone, on their tablets. You don't get always people sitting in front of the TV like they used to. So programs, you know, viewership is down across the entire spectrum of programming on television. Is that why viewership is down for the NFL, or is it, you know, other issues with people with being uneasy about the concussion issue, with them not liking the quality of play, with them being upset about the protests? Maybe all of those thrown in together. So I don't think you can really have this direct line from, you know, the anger over the protests equals the drop in television ratings. But I do think, anecdotally, when you hear how upset some fans are and owners talk about what they hear from their fans and from their sponsors, I think owners at least believe that there is some effect being had on the business, for sure.
Mark Maskey is with us. He covers the NFL for the Washington Post, looking at player protests during the national anthem and the owners, NFL owners' response to that. And Mark, you've covered meetings between NFL owners and some of the activist players, and they're negotiating on doing some different kinds of things that aren't directly related to the protest. What are you seeing out there?
You know, if people, you know, remember going back to October, there was the meeting in New York where the players, some of the players met with some of the owners. And then immediately after that, the owners kind of segued into their regularly scheduled meeting. And then the owners came out of that meeting without passing a rule that required the players to stand for the anthem. And if you remember what they said at the time, Roger Goodell and the owners said, you know, we want the players to stand for the anthem. We believe that's important. We know our fans want that, but we're not ready to take that step. So what the owners and Roger Goodell said at that time was their focus would be on these discussions that they're having with the players about the potential for league support, league financing of the initiatives that players want to do in terms of social justice and activism in their communities. Fast forward to now, to Wednesday night, we saw that agreement come about. There's going to be about $90 million over a span of 6 or 7 years that's funneled by the league into these programs, focused especially on the African-American community. And that's sort of, when you go back to October and the owners saying that they weren't going to force the players to stand, clearly the hope was that if they could come to an agreement on this issue, on the funding of the activism, that that would lead the players to voluntarily stand for the anthem. Now, the problem with that thinking now is that in the last, 48 hours or so, we've seen sort of the player side fractionalized. We've seen divisions on the player side. The lead people in these deliberations with the league were Malcolm Jenkins of the Eagles and Anquan Boldin, the retired wide receiver. Well, their group called the Players Coalition, we've seen players break off from that. We've seen very notably Eric Reed of the 49ers, who knelt with Colin Kaepernick last season, has been very prominent in continuing to protest during the anthem this season. We've seen him break off and say, the Players Coalition doesn't speak for me anymore. So now you would think that at this point with that agreement in place, the players who are part of the Players Coalition, the Malcolm Jenkins group, we will probably see them stop their protesting now that this agreement is in place. But the Eric Reed and the players who have broken away, we will probably see them continue to protest. So this will not be sort of the ultimate catch-all solution that many owners maybe wanted from this. And I think we're going to see the protests continue and possibly through the end of the season. And that goes back to what we originally talked about. That could lead the owners then in the off season, if they think that this is still hurting the league and hurting the business, perhaps do something in the off season to change the anthem policy heading into next season.
And where is Colin Kaepernick now? He's not playing. He's a quarterback. There have been a lot of prominent quarterback injuries in the NFL, including at Green Bay. He's not in the league, though.
He's not in the league. He has filed a grievance against the teams and the owners, accusing them of collusion. We'll see where that goes. But he certainly is a presence. I mean, he has been a presence over this controversy the entire season. He has remained connected to this issue, especially through Eric Reed, his former teammate with the 49ers. We've heard his name come up often in terms of the deliberations and why is he not at this meeting and why is he not part of these deliberations. So he very much remains a presence on this issue, although he's not a presence on the field and he's not playing. And going forward, it will be interesting to see when we get a little further removed from this issue and if the volume gets turned down a little bit on the controversy, if a team goes ahead and signs him this coming offseason, or if this is it. The further you get away from playing, presumably the less effective you become and the less of a solution you look like to a team, that in terms of just your on-field ability. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in terms of him as a player this coming offseason.
Briefly, Mark, do you see the volume being turned down anytime soon on this?
Not really, because what really turned the volume up, as everyone knows, is when the president weighed in on this. And it's an issue that works for the president. Certainly not everyone agrees with him, but his base certainly agrees with him. It's an issue that plays very well to his base. We've seen it, at certain times. Some people think he's just sort of changing the national conversation, going back to criticizing the NFL and criticizing the players who kneel and protest during the anthem. It's an issue that has worked for him. It's an issue that resonates very much with the people who are like-minded with him on this issue. So I think for that reason, we will not see it turned down, simply because it's something that the president is likely to come back to, and it's something that those fans who are upset about it, we don't really know.
And I got to jump in. Mark, thanks for joining us. That was Mark Maskey, Washington Post NFL reporter, looking at NFL player protests. Pope Francis visited Myanmar this week. The Southeast Asian country, formerly known as Burma, is ruled by a repressive military regime, but Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi has a significant public role in the country as well. The Rohingya minority there has been the subject of persecution, according to Doctors Without Borders. Over 600,000 have fled to neighboring Bangladesh since the end of August. Rebecca Hamilton's an assistant professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. She specializes in human rights and has served as a lawyer on the International Criminal Court. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why is the Pope visiting Myanmar now?
Well, the Myanmar is a crisis that the UN has described as textbook ethnic cleansing. And I would go further and say that the situation for the Rohingya people in Myanmar is looking like genocide. So we have one of the worst humanitarian crises of our time, and he is there to raise the situation as well as to provide support for the effort for a democratic transition in Myanmar.
Does someone like the Pope have a moral persuasive power in a place like Myanmar, which has a Catholic minority, but a small Catholic minority?
Yes. So, I mean, clearly the Pope has a moral authority that speaks beyond the borders of Myanmar. So irrespective of the size of the Catholic population in the country, when he speaks to a global audience. And so I think his remarks should be seen in that context. Now, one concern that was raised in advance of his visit is whether by speaking out on behalf of the Rohingya population, which are this persecuted, primarily Muslim population in one part of Myanmar, whether by doing that he could risk the safety of this minority Catholic population in Myanmar. And that was something that he had to balance as he prepared for this trip.
Observers were listening closely to whether he would mention the Rohingya specifically, as you're saying, with those warnings in mind. Let's listen to a bit of his address there, speaking through a translator.
The future of Myanmar must be peace, a peace based on respect for the dignity and rights of each member of society, respect for each ethnic group and its identity, respect for the rule of law, and respect for a democratic order that enables each individual and every group, non-excluded, to offer its legitimate contribution to the common good.
The Pope is not generally known as somebody who pulls punches or minces words. Why might he have made the decision not to refer to the Rohingya by name, building on what you were saying just before?
Yeah, so I think it's extremely telling of just how grave a situation the Rohingya face, that even the Pope, this Pope, as you mentioned, who is not known for pulling his punches, has been, at least relative to his predecessors, very outspoken on behalf of marginalized people, that he nonetheless made the calculation that using the term Rohingya would create more harm than good. And I think it shows us just the power of the military in Myanmar, who have been pushing this persecution of the Rohingya. And it's not just the military. It is happening at a society-wide level. It is very difficult to find anyone in Myanmar, including people that human rights advocates can typically consider as being, quote-unquote, on their side, who are willing to stand up for the Rohingya. So their situation is full of peril, and I assume that the Pope has made the calculation that it would be just inflammatory to use the term that they call themselves against the will of the military in Myanmar and, in fact, the general population.
Right. As I understand it, the Rohingya population in Myanmar, at least in some ways, goes back literally centuries. There was some migration back and forth during British colonial times. But the government, the official stance in Myanmar is the Rohingya don't exist. They call it a migrant population from other countries. They're not listed as official citizens of the country. Is that right?
That's right. So you have this population who have been stripped of their citizenship. They're now stateless and are being denied the ability to even call themselves by the name that they identify themselves as. To my earlier point about the signs of genocide, and when you're looking at the destruction of a group, surely denying a group the ability to even call themselves by the name that they choose, and having so much power that we're in a situation now where even someone with the moral authority of the Pope has bought into that, you just see how marginalized the Rohingya are in their own country.
We're talking to Rebecca Hamilton from American University about the Rohingya in Myanmar and the Pope's visit there this week. And you've mentioned the word a couple times, genocide, Rebecca. And I think sometimes when we're just talking about a situation, we use it in a casual sense. But does it have a formal legal definition? And if this is legally defined as a genocide, does it call on world governments to take particular actions?
Yes. So yes to both parts of that question. I think there is a huge risk of overusing the word genocide. Genocide has taken on a popular connotation, and victims and survivors in a number of different situations will invoke the term genocide in a way that taps into the popular imagination but is not in compliance with the strict legal definition. The strict legal definition turns on the intent to destroy a group. So a range of horrific actions such as murder and rape and torture, these can be any number of different crimes under international law, but when they are committed with the intent to destroy a particular group, in this case the Rohingya, that's the scenario that we reserve the legal term genocide for. And I think that we see with this culmination of factors, the stripping of the citizenship, the refusal to even acknowledge the Rohingya as a group as they identify themselves, these are the kinds of factors that an international court would look at when they're trying to infer whether there is an intent to destroy a group as such.
That's genocide. How about ethnic cleansing? It seems clear that at the very least that's what's going on in Myanmar. I think it's safe to say, does that have similar international definitions and consequences?
It is not actually a legal term, ethnic cleansing. So there's no question that ethnic cleansing is taking place as the term is being used to describe people who are being persecuted and pushed out of their homes. The UN has said that's happening, and I don't think there is much debate about that outside Myanmar itself. But it doesn't have the same legal weight as the term genocide. But I think, you know, what is really important to emphasize is that no matter what we end up calling this, let's not get tied up in the semantics. Let's realize that we have a population that are in immense peril. And no matter what terminology is used, the governments of the world have a responsibility to protect this population who have been rendered stateless, who have no other state that is looking out for their interests.
Looking at a case like this from the United States, or where you've done more of your work in Africa, it can seem like the situations are so distant, complicated in some cases, that it's beyond the power of a country, even like the United States, to make a difference. Can a country like the United States and the rest of the world community prevent genocide?
We have to try. And what seems clear and what we've been learning over time as we have kept trying and failing and sometimes not even trying to prevent genocide is that rarely is it going to turn on the action of one country alone. But that is not a reason for each country not to try. So it is not an excuse to say, well, the U.S. has relatively less power in this situation, which it does. You know, there are regional players that are probably more influential here, but that doesn't let the U.S. off the hook. It is going to take the combined efforts of each powerful nation in order to change the dynamic here.
Do you worry that, given that this is in part a refugee situation with Rohingya fleeing into Bangladesh, a Rohingya population here as far away as Wisconsin, for that matter, that it just gets merged into what's perceived as a global refugee crisis, Africa, Syria, Afghanistan, now Myanmar, and it doesn't get the individual attention that it might deserve?
Yes, I do think that's a risk. And I also think, you know, why it's important to bring back this contentious word genocide into the conversation is that there are particular dynamics of the situation for the Rohingya that merit particular attention above and beyond the many crises that are happening in terms of refugee flows and migration around the world. And there is a particular responsibility on governments to attend to this one because of the risk of the destruction of this group as a group.
I want to bring this back to the Pope's visit there. He didn't, as we mentioned, say the name Rohingya. He didn't address that specifically. He talked about human rights and civil rights. But he met with Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, kind of the de facto leader of Burma, who has been criticized for not speaking out to stop this. Even if the Pope didn't mention the Rohingya, do you think his visit could make a difference on their behalf?
Yes, I certainly hope so. And what we don't know is what is said behind closed doors. So it is one thing not to mention the Rohingya in a public statement, but we have to hope and expect that he advocated on their behalf in those meetings that we had, both with Aung San Suu Kyi, but also with one of the military generals. So, you know, there are many ways to address a human rights crisis, and not all of it has to involve public diplomacy. So that's important to remember. But the other thing that I heard in the remarks that you played was his emphasis about the importance of this democratic transition. And I think there is a risk here. So, yes, a democratic transition is incredibly important, but let us not kid ourselves into believing that that will solve the situation for the Rohingya population in Myanmar. Because even under a democratic system, they are still facing those same society-wide discrimination laws and general attitude that has plagued their group for decades upon decades. And a transition to democracy is not going to resolve that.
Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Hamilton is an assistant professor of law at American University and a specialist in human rights. She previously served as a lawyer in the prosecutorial division of the International Criminal Court. She's written books about genocide. She joined us to talk about the Pope's visit to Myanmar this week. Burmese people are, by the way, actually the fastest growing refugee group here in Wisconsin. For reporting on their lives and experience here, visit wiscontext.org. Coming up, President Trump offended many Native Americans at a White House event honoring Navajo code talkers. A member of Wisconsin's Native community shares her reaction. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Native Americans played huge roles in the U.S. military through the wars of the 20th century, and the Navajo Code Talkers of World War II became one of the most famous and celebrated examples of that after their work was declassified more than 20 years after the war. They used the Navajo language to send encoded messages that enemies wouldn't be able to crack. In World War I, a similar code effort used the Choctaw language. This week, the White House held an event to honor the remaining Navajo code talkers of World War II, but the event quickly became controversial because of comments that many Native Americans called offensive. In his speech, President Trump called out a political opponent, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, by referring to her as Pocahontas. It's a nickname the president gave her that draws on her claims of Cherokee and Delaware Indian ancestry. Here's a listen.
You're very, very special people. You were here long before any of us were here. Although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you because you are special.
Arvina Martin is an alderwoman on the Madison Common Council. She's an enrolled member of the Ho-Chunk Nation and is Stockbridge Muncie. She wrote an opinion piece for NBC this week calling the president's comments a mockery of Native American history. We have a link to that on our website. Arvina, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what was your first reaction when you heard those comments from the president?
I think that it was a combination of shock and, oh yeah, that was going to happen. That unfortunately seems to happen a lot of times when the president speaks.
And here's what the president of the Navajo Nation, Russell Bige, had to say about the president's comments, speaking here on MSNBC.
This is where we're honoring and respecting our veterans, especially our code talkers, and to put in a slur that has become racial, Pocahontas, didn't belong there. It was inappropriate, was not a time to do it, was not a place to do it. This was a time to lift up the veterans, especially the code talkers, and the contribution to this nation.
And I want to untangle a couple parts of that. You write in your piece that mentioning Pocahontas' name itself isn't necessarily a slur in and of itself, but in this case, it felt like one. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, Pocahontas was a real person who her story has been has gone through many revisions. You know, we think of the Disney version of her because of the movie with that name. But unfortunately, that's not what happened. You know, she was ultimately kidnapped by the English that then took her back to England, and that is unfortunately where she passed away. But she was a child. She was likely a victim of sexual assault and kidnapping. So she is a person in our history. She is someone that we are proud of for persevering. But at the same time, that's not the way that President Trump used her name. He used it as a slur. He used it as a cut. He was not trying to define Senator Warren because of some attributes that he thought were similar that were positive. He was using it to malign her.
And then there's the setting of this ceremony honoring Navajo code talkers, some of the few who still survive so many years after the war. And that was a big part of what you wrote about, the setting here.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that under any other administration would be considered a gimme. It's pretty easy to go and listen to what the veterans are going to say. Peter McDonald was one of the code talkers who spoke. He's in his 90s. The three that are there were all in their 90s. And he told stories about what happened to each one of those veterans that was there. One was spent a year in a naval hospital recovering from injuries that he sustained while in war. And another was at the Battle of Iwo Jima, or on the island of Iwo Jima, rather. And he enlisted himself when he was 15 to help. You know, this is a time where you should listen to the stories that they're willing to tell and appreciate them. That's the whole point of the ceremony. There is no reason for Senator Warren's name to come up at all.
Talking to Arvina Martin of Wisconsin, looking at President Trump and the ceremony, honoring Navajo code talkers. And as we've talked about on the show in the past, veterans play a big part in Native American culture. Native Americans make up a big part, a disproportionate part, in most cases, of the American military. Can you talk about that relationship?
Yeah, actually, you know, there were quite a few Natives that enlisted to serve in World War II, even though Native people did not have U.S. citizenship at that time. It wasn't granted until after World War I. But people still enlisted because protecting your home is a very important duty, and we are very protective of our veterans. We honor them. They've done great things for us, and so we have to make sure we take care of them. It lost my train of thought there, but yes, the Natives actually also serve at the highest rate out of any ethnic group in the United States in the armed services, based on numbers from the Department of Defense.
And in a press conference, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, presidential spokesperson, was asked about this, and she said that she was worried that the media wasn't paying enough attention to Elizabeth Warren and her claims of Native American ancestry. Can you talk about that story a little?
Well, first, to that point, I would say that this was not an event to talk about Elizabeth Warren's heritage. This was to honor those veterans that had served in World War II and served bravely and honorably. Senator Warren has stated that she has heard family stories that she is of Cherokee and I believe Delaware descent, and put that on her professional and educational bios. She's never researched it. It's people who do tribal genealogy have not been able to find any trace of this ancestry in her background, which is what the president jumped on.
But again, as you were saying, this wasn't the time or place for the political dig, as you saw it.
Exactly. This had nothing to do with Senator Warren at all. It was a complete non sequitur.
You also write about the president's comments. We heard his praise of Native Americans being, you were something to the effect of, you were here before all of us. And that being just one small point to bring up there. But talk about that statement.
I would consider this the point where he tried to white mansplain Native history to a group of three tribal elders. You know, we know that we've been here. He doesn't need to tell us that. To me, that sounded like he didn't do his research and was thinking of things to say. And even earlier when he discussed, you know, what did they do? He had to ask his chief of staff, oh, are these guys any good? And probably the most real moment of that was when he was recounting this story and said, you know, General Kelly told me, you have no idea. I mean, obviously he has no idea. He didn't do any of the research. He didn't, and just pulled out whatever he wanted to, whatever he could think of about Native people. He just brought it out.
Can you talk a little more about the Code Talkers, their story, and why we should remember it?
The Code Talkers were incredibly brave. There are the Navajo Code Talkers, which by far are the largest amount of Code Talkers. But there were also Code Talkers from 33 other tribes. I believe in Wisconsin, we had Ho-Chunk Code Talkers, as well as Oneida and Menominee. Forgive me if I'm forgetting some. But, you know, people went and served and used these codes that were never cracked. And they weren't allowed to say anything because this was so important. They transmitted information securely and safely and accurately so that many lives of Allied soldiers were defended and were protected. You know, they couldn't tell anybody at home what they were doing. They just said, yep, I'm going to the war. They couldn't say anything for till 1968. So a lot of people didn't know the amazing sacrifice and the code that they developed and carried out.
We're talking to Arvina Martin, Alderwoman on Madison's Common Council and enrolled member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She's sharing her thoughts on President Trump's Pocahontas remarks at a White House event this week honoring Navajo Code Talkers, survivors from World War II. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What did you think of this White House event honoring the Navajo Code Talkers? And what did you think of the president's comments at that event? What do you think of the reaction to those comments? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're continuing our conversation now with Arvina Martin, Alderwoman on Madison's Common Council. She's an enrolled member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. We're looking at President Trump using the nickname Pocahontas for Senator Elizabeth Warren in the midst of a White House event honoring Navajo Code Talkers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to these comments? Do you think it was a problem or a symbolic, not a big deal? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Simmer is on the line in Milwaukee. Simmer, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, guys. Great. Always a great program.
Thanks.
I just wanted to make a quick remark. Like, I kind of, like, read a little bit more about the Code Talkers after I saw all of this. It kind of struck me that there was they were honored in front of a portrait of Andrew Jackson. From what I read, wasn't he the president who pushed the Indians out, and wasn't there something called the Trail of Tears? I also found that setting a little, like, odd. I'm like, so...
Simmer, thanks for the call. And he wasn't alone, right, Arvina?
Yeah, that was glaringly obvious. And it was just kind of like that extra stab with the knife. Yes, President Andrew Jackson was the architect of the Indian Removal Act that led to the Trail of Tears. There were various Supreme Court decisions designed to stop that, but he said, nope, we're doing it anyways. And that led to thousands of people losing their homelands, as well as thousands of people dying en route.
Simmer, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to contribute. I teach at a Native American community college. I'm not Native, but I teach it primarily a Native student body at a Native college. And we discussed Trump's remarks in class briefly. And the comments of my students, many of whom are young, some of whom are mature, was the word narcissistic, that Trump simply has an inability to appreciate history and to simply honor the veterans and focus on the event as opposed to himself and his political opponents. And another word that was used, or a phrase, was gross immaturity, and I'd be interested in your guest response.
Jim, thanks. Arvina?
I think that's dead on. I mean, we've seen from the president's behavior in other situations that he really likes to talk about himself in at times where a president normally does not talk about him or herself. You know, even in the quote I mentioned about him talking to General Kelly about not knowing how good they were, how good the Code Talkers were. You know, part of this thing that he said was, you know, they love their country just like you love your country. And so he couldn't even get that positive comment out without throwing himself into it again.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Arvina Martin, looking at President Trump's comments at a ceremony honoring Navajo Code Talkers from World War II, some of the few survivors of that era. What would you like to see from President Trump or his administration, maybe to make amends, do a little better on these issues as you see it?
There is so much room for improvement. First of all, he could take that painting of Andrew Jackson out of the Oval Office. That would be fabulous. A lot of people saw that as a smack in the face when he put that back. He can pay attention to issues of tribal sovereignty that are going to be affecting all tribes. There are 567 federally recognized tribes in the United States that he needs to work with. And that he needs to understand that. Back when he was doing his casino developing, he referred to a tribe that's not Indians because they didn't look like Indians to him. You know, he needs to understand. He needs a very basic understanding of Native history in the United States before he can move on.
Now, looking at past presidents, I mean, maybe some have done better on symbolic issues. Do you see previous White House administrations doing much better in terms of the issues you were just talking about?
Yeah. For example, in the previous administration, President Obama helped with the Violence Against Women Act that provided protection for women on tribal lands who were assaulted or attacked by people who are not members of that tribe, because previously tribal courts didn't have any jurisdiction over such cases, which meant that a lot of people just went free and unpunished. So, you know, he did that. He put the Bear's Ears Monument into a protected status. It's a very sacred spot for the folks down there in the Southwest. You know, and he hosted a tribal leaders conference every year. And tribal presidents, chairmen, chiefs would go out to D.C. and meet with him and meet with each other. And that happened every year. And that's the kind of communication we need going forward.
I want to go back to our callers now. Richard is with us in Lime Ridge. Richard, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Richard?
Okay. I attended the Crow Canyon Archaeological Center in Cortez, Colorado, several different summers working on excavating, and at a community college nearby they usually had different events where they'd bring in Native Americans to talk from the Four Corners region. And one evening they had three Code Talkers there who explained about their mission in the war. And the one thing I think the president should know about them is they had an armed guard with them when they were in combat area to relay messages. The armed guard's job was to shoot the Code Talker if there is a chance they were going to be captured. I just thought that should be brought out, that, you know, they were in a really tough situation as they were dealing with sending out coded messages.
Richard, thanks for the call. Arvina, I mean, hearing stories like Richard heard there, do you think more of us need to hear those stories about the Code Talkers?
Definitely. And if there's something positive that comes out of this, it is that people are talking about the contribution the Code Talkers have made to the efforts in World War II and World War I. You know, they did remarkable and were very brave and carried out their missions. And again, the code was never cracked by anybody.
Thanks for the call, Richard. We go next to Mike on the line in La Crosse. Mike, hi.
Hi there. I just got a little different slant on it. I think Trump, being the racist that he is, he can't look at a person or a people of color who were actual heroes compared to himself, who was coward and had to get out of serving in the Vietnam War. That's just my take on it.
Mike, thanks for the call. Mike saying there's a wider problem of President Trump dealing with non-white veterans.
I think that we've seen from a lot of the policies and things that he's said since he's taken office that he probably does have some problems with people of color generally. I think that's an easy assessment to make.
Thanks for the call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. Are there places in American politics nowadays outside of the White House where you see more positive developments going on in relationships with Native American communities?
Here in Wisconsin, I know that there was an act passed by Governor Doyle when he was in office that has been consistently reenacted every year that requires all the departments to consult with tribes on their policies. So I worked at the Department of Transportation for a while and working on issues that relate to tribes, meeting and having consultation sessions where tribal leaders can come and have their concerns addressed. That's the kind of government-to-government relationship that is important in order to make this whole state work well.
Time for one more caller. Janine is with us in Vesper. Janine, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say, too, that nobody seems to talk about it, but those Navajo Code Talkers stood up for a country that never stood up for them, that tried to wipe out their language, that tried to wipe out who they were and their traditions, and yet they stood up for the country, and we have a president who can think of nothing but taking care of himself.
Janine, thanks for the call. You touched on that briefly earlier, Arvina. You want to talk about that a little more?
Yeah, I think it's pretty remarkable that this nation that has historically tried to destroy Native communities and languages were ultimately aided by those languages that the country tried to destroy as a federal policy. You know, they helped out. And I think that's outstanding.
This has clearly started a conversation mm-hmm. about Native Americans, Native American veterans in particular. Do you see potentially, Arvina, as we wrap up, some positives coming out of that conversation?
Yeah. Again, as I said before, people are talking about issues faced by veterans, are talking about the sacrifices that they made. And again, getting some attention and acclaim for these folks, that these really brave veterans that did amazing things for our country, and they weren't allowed to celebrate when they came home.
We'll leave it there for now. Arvina, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Arvina Martin. She's an alderwoman on the Madison Common Council, and she's an enrolled member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She joined us today to tell us why she believes the president's comments at a White House event honoring Navajo Code Talkers made a mockery of Native American history. The link to a piece she wrote about that, by the way, you can find that via the Ideas Network Facebook page.